The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, I'm Josh Levine, Slate's national editor and the author of The Queen. This is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of September 9th, 2019. On this week's show, the New Yorker's Louisa Thomas will join us to talk about Bianca Andreescu's big win over Serena Williams at the U.S. Open and Rafael Nadal's remarkable five-set victory over Daniil Medvedev. Our colleague Ben Mathis-Lilly will also be here to assess Antonio Brown's transcendent, if short-lived, career with the Oakland Raiders and his escape to the New England Patriots. We'll also discuss the Clemson Tigers college football dynasty and the perhaps over-the-top, maybe creepy techniques its coaches and staffers have used to build and maintain it. Joining me in Slate's Washington, D.C. studio is Stefan Fatsis. He's the author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Stefan, I'm upset with you.
Why?
You know why. Because at the end of the Greece-U.S. game in the Basketball World Cup, your countrymen, the lesser Antetokounmpo fantasy, flagrantly, maliciously fouled my countryman, Harrison Barnes. And no apology from you, from any of the Greece players.
We apologize to no one. For nothing.
No one for nothing. I like it. That's the Greece, the national motto.
Yes. Since when are you a big Harrison Barnes defender anyway?
Love Harrison Barnes. You know, anyone who wears the red, white, and blue and the stars and stripes, I'm a fan of theirs.
And whoever wears the blue and white, I'm a fan of. Zito Elada.
All right. Agree to disagree. Serena Williams won her 23rd Grand Slam title at the 2017 Australian Open, beating her sister Venus while, amazingly, she was pregnant with her daughter Alexis Olympia. A year and a half later, after a difficult pregnancy and birth and a bunch of injuries, Serena even more amazingly made it all the way to the Wimbledon final before losing to Angelique Kerber. In the next Grand Slam after that, she lost to Naomi Osaka in the U.S. Open final, the match made famous by her series of confrontations with chair umpire Carlos Ramos. This year, after losing in the quarterfinals in Australia and the third round of the French Open, Serena made it back to the Wimbledon final, where she got blown out by Simona Halep. And this past weekend, in yet another U.S. Open final, Serena Williams failed for the fourth time to secure her 24th Grand Slam, losing in straight sets to Canadian teenager Bianca Andreescu. Here is Serena in her post-match press conference.
It's really hard right now to take that moment in and to say you did okay. Because I don't believe I did, you know? And I believe I could have played better, and I believe I could have done more, and I believe that I could have just been been more Serena today. And I honestly don't think Serena showed up, and I have to kind of figure out how to get her to show up in Grand Slam finals.
Joining us now is Louisa Thomas of The New Yorker. Great to have you on, as always, Louisa.
Great to be on.
So if there was any doubt before, Serena Williams losing in Grand Slam finals is now officially a thing. We just heard in that clip Serena acknowledge as much. It was, for her, a very open and introspective Q&A session. Andreescu played very well. We'll talk about her more in a minute. But it seemed to me, Louisa, and I'm curious if it did to you, that Serena was struggling mentally in that match.
Absolutely. I mean, it came out in her second serve especially. Serena's serve has always been her most imposing weapon, and both her first serve and her second serve just weren't there this weekend. You could tell that she was tight, she was nervous, and this is definitely a pattern. It's also true that Bianca Andreescu is probably the best player in the world right now, not Serena Williams, and that probably unnerved her too.
Except that Serena was so dominant in the earlier rounds. I mean, she completely demolished Maria Sharapova in the first round of this tournament. She completely demolished her opponent in the quarterfinals. What was that, 6-1, 6-love?
In 44 minutes.
In 44 minutes. I mean, it did not look, going into this final, like, oh, Serena's still on the way back. It looked like she was back.
She is healthier. She's moving better, as you wrote in your piece, Louisa.
The movement really stood out in this tournament. Every other slam going in, I was, you know what, this is, she is such a fierce competitor that I always thought, you know, she would really have a strong chance of coming through. But she was moving so well. And in that semifinal match against Elena Svitolina, she was moving phenomenally. I mean, she was moving as well as I've ever seen her move. I really thought, oh, wow, this is Serena, as Serena would say. Serena is back. but it wasn't there.
So, you know, to answer your question, Stefan, I think one of the reasons that she looked so dominant in, you know, the first big chunk of the tournament was that she was playing well. She got out to leads and she was playing opponents who she could dominate both physically and mentally. Like none of the folks that she was playing in the first, you know, six matches in the US Open were on her level. She lost a set to Katie McNally, 17-year-old American, who did not look afraid against Serena, but nobody else really went up to her level. But in this final, as it happened with Simona Halep and Naomi Osaka and Angelique Kerber in the previous finals, she was up against an opponent who did not fear her, who got out to a really good start. And perhaps the fact that, you know, Serena was not clearly the best player on the court, that's what led her to kind of spiral and get down so far that when she did finally come back, it was too little, too late.
It definitely felt like the emotional vulnerability was exploited by Andreescu. I mean, the announcers, I don't know who it was, whether it was Chris Everett or John McEnroe, but someone said at the very beginning that Andreescu deferred. She won the coin toss and could have served first, but she allowed Serena to serve first, knowing that if she broke her, that she had this plan. If she broke her, she knew that would affect Serena immediately. And she broke her.
She always elects to return, I believe. She said that afterwards. So that wasn't so much of a power play. But it did work. and it's also true that in her press conference, she said that, you know, she thought that maybe Serena was a little bit intimidated by her returns. And I heard that. I was like, wow, I've really never heard anyone say, I think that I intimidated Serena Williams. But you know what? Maybe she's not wrong, because her pressure on Serena serves was really stood out. Serena was serving terribly. That is absolutely true. She was returning really well and really aggressively. The amazing thing about her, though, is that that's not all her game is. She has touch. She has feel. She takes a lot of pace off the ball sometimes. You know, anyone who just watched her in the final thinks, oh my gosh, she's a woman who hits the ball just 90 miles an hour. And that's true. But if you watch some of her other matches, you would see someone who's playing with a lot of variation, a lot of different spins. I mean, one of the reasons she's so exciting is that she has such a complete game.
We'll get to Nadal and Medvedev in a second, but there are a lot of parallels between Andreescu and Medvedev in terms of how strong they've been this year. They've had the best kind of run-up to the U.S. Open of anybody in the game, and you saw that confidence with both of them. And with Andreescu, you know, we can probably make a little bit too much of this, but it's hard not to notice her yelling out, come on, just being so demonstrative in a way that in Serena's matches, it's usually Serena that way and that a woman on the other side of the court is silent. But Andreescu is not deferential. She has no reason to be. She's the best player, has been the best player in the world on form and on results all year. And in order for Serena Williams to win this match, even though she's looked good, she was going to have to play the best match that she's played probably in her comeback. And she just wasn't able to muster that in this moment. There was one thing, like Chris Everett was saying in the post-match, like in all these finals and all four of them, like these women played the matches of their lives. I don't think that's true. That's an exaggeration. Andreescu's been playing awesome all year.
She's 8-0 against top 10 players in her career.
And I think it's just putting blinders on to say that Serena had nothing to do with this and that Andreescu just played like super lights out. You saw when Serena started to play well in the second set that she could hang with her and could beat her. She just wasn't playing well enough.
Yeah, she didn't start though until she was down 1-5 in the second set.
I mean, I completely agree. Halep did play the match of her life. Andreescu didn't. I think that a lot of Serena's hesitation might have had to do with the fact that, you know, we talk about her quarterfinal match, which she won in 44 minutes. I saw that described, I can't remember who did it, but as batting practice. And that's true. You know, if you tee up a certain kind of ball for Serena, she will pound it for winners all day long. But Andreescu really had a plan, and she probably had a backup plan and a backup plan and a backup plan. And Serena knew that too.
Back to Andreescu for a second. How much, Louisa, do you feel like players like her learn from Serena? I mean, this is a young woman. She's 19. You know, 4 years ago, she said that she was like writing her name on fictitious U.S. Open trophy checks to get psyched about her future career. But she plays.
Did she get arrested for passing bad checks? Or was...
yeah. She plays.
She'd update it every year. Yeah.
It's not just that she is strong and powerful and has adopted a lot of the tactics that Serena has used against weaker opponents. It's that she displays this raw, aggressive confidence. There is no fear there. This is like no bullshit athlete.
It's hard to know what's inherited or what's her own personality. I mean, I look at her mother and I think, okay, this is a girl who was raised in a family that, you know, really encouraged her to be herself in the very best way. But also it is absolutely true that Serena Williams helped establish this real like right for young women to stand up for themselves and be strong and be proud and competitive and ambitious in ways that, you know, maybe they haven't always in the past. I mean, I really do think that she modeled a certain kind of confidence that Andreescu is showing in spades.
Last quick thought on this is that I think similar to LeBron James, we can maybe punish Serena for making these finals and losing in them, just like LeBron has a bad record in the finals because he actually made it there. You know, Roger Federer, who's very similar in age to Serena, 38 years old, loses in the quarterfinals, kind of goes away against Dimitrov, whether it was because of stamina or injury, we don't know. But, you know, Federer was not in the final to suffer a mental, lapse like Serena Williams did. So it's, you know, nobody in the sport, despite the fact that she hasn't been able to get number 24, has had a strong run of Grand Slam performances as Serena Williams has had since she came back from having her child. It's very impressive.
Totally impressive. Four final. I mean, it's unbelievable. Nobody's shown that high level consistency.
Somebody pointed out that Serena Williams is the same age as Lindsay Davenport, Martina Hingis, Justine Henin, and Kim Clijsters.
It's amazing.
All right, let's talk about the men's final. On Sunday, Rafael Nadal took a 2-set lead over Daniil Medvedev. Even Medvedev himself said he was starting to think about his loser's speech. And then he came back from a breakdown in the third, won the third, won the fourth, and fell behind in the fifth, but actually had a break point to get it back even in the fifth set before Nadal prevailed. 19th Grand Slam title for Nadal, one behind Federer for the all-time lead. But let's talk about this match and talk about Medvedev. This was an incredibly impressive performance and comeback by him. And the match was just played at an unbelievable level. The baseline rallies were long and torturous, and they were, you know, still playing at that level after 4.5 hours.
This guy is amazing. I had no idea what to expect. I texted a friend after Nadal went up 30-love in the match, and I said, Medvedev's not going to win a single point. And I texted him, you know, a few minutes later and said, because this friend actually, I think, has a game that looks just like Medvedev's. I was like, congratulations, you're making the US Open final next year. He's got this ability to suffer in front of our eyes, and he just brought it. It was unbelievable. I had no idea what to expect at any point in that match.
We haven't seen anybody, Stefan, I think, like him. He's tall and skinny, 6'6", but he doesn't just move well for a big guy. He moves as well, I think, as maybe anybody except for Novak Djokovic in all of men's tennis. And I don't know who's training this guy, but somebody has, like, it usually takes a long time. Like, he's never won a 5-set match. It usually takes a long time for guys to build up stamina. But his ability to hang in with Nadal in these long baseline rallies and actually get the better of Nadal for a long period of the match in these long rallies. It's not like he was only winning when he had big serves. This guy is, like, weird. He's like a freak.
Well, physically, you do not look at Medvedev and think, oh, fantastic athlete. This guy's going to be at the top of a sport for 15 years. But the intensity of those rallies were incredible. And as Luisa, you just pointed out, the fact that he was on the brink of losing in straight sets and losing that third set like 6-2 and comes back and pushes it to 5 was really remarkable. And what makes it difficult to go the distance against Nadal, and how did Medvedev do that?
I think that he's sort of, once he decided to dig in, he was like, well, it's going to be 5 hours and it's going to hurt. And here we are. And it did. I mean, I do think a couple of things. One, it's amazing the way he did it. I just said dug in, but it's not like he just kept grinding. He started serving and volleying. You know, he was doing all sorts of weird, different, unusual things for him. He's one of these people who just is willing to try anything and everything if it helps him win. And lately, it's been helping him win a lot. I do think maybe we've all been a little punked, you know. He looks like he's about to keel over, but actually, you know, he can almost outlast the guy that nobody in the world can outlast. I think that he is so much fun to watch. His game is really weird. It's very like public courts in this kind of really interesting way. He looks like he's just been almost self-taught. I was sort of joking that Bianca Andreescu is like Medvedev with technique, you know? I mean, he's just like, I don't know how he learned to play tennis or where, but I want to go sign up.
So Andreescu is the first player, man or woman, to win a Grand Slam in singles that's born in the 2000s. Medvedev in this match became the first man born in the 1990s to ever win two sets in a Grand Slam final. Like that's
so dark.
That whole generation. He's like redeeming the like lost generation of men's tennis with this performance. And, you know, it's kind of joking, but we've been waiting for a decade to see somebody from the like next generation stand up to Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, and to some extent, Murray. And it's just never happened. Even with this match, for the last 3 years, it's only the big three that have won majors. And Medvedev is, you know, maybe he saw Andreescu and got inspired. Like, he didn't look afraid. He hasn't looked afraid all summer. And maybe it will, like, be inspiring for the whole field that he fell behind two sets against the greatest fighter and maybe the history of the sport, and he didn't succumb and had Nadal, it looked like for a minute where he wanted him. And it's not like he lost the match because of any kind of weakness. Like, he just got beat. That's all.
The other reason I think this is hope inspiring is that, you know, we've still got 4 or 5 more years of Nadal and Djokovic. They're 32 and 33, and they are performing still at an incredibly high level. So I think it's really important for men's tennis that someone from the younger generation has demonstrated they can get to a final and make a run at a final against one of these guys.
All right, let's talk about the other factor with Medvedev, which is his personality and attitude. I talked couple weeks ago, I was ahead of the curve on this, people, about how he got defaulted from a match on the Challenger Tour for saying that a black chair umpire and his black opponent were quote-unquote friends, which does not reflect super well on him. He also threw coins at an umpire at Wimbledon. Then at the U.S. Open, he kind of took this penchant for conflict to a new level. In his third-round match with Feliciano Lopez, he snatched a towel away from a ball man, and that led the crowd to be increasingly angry at him and boo him. And Medvedev won, and this is what he had to say to the crowd after the match.
First of all, what I can say that thank you all, guys, because your energy tonight give me the win. Because if you were not here, guys, I would probably lose the match. Because I was so tired, I was cramping yesterday, it was so tough for me to play. So I want all of you to know, when you sleep tonight, I won because of you.
The "when you sleep tonight," I think, is the best part. Louisa, how did he go from that moment of playing up, like hamishly playing the villain and trolling the crowd, to being a guy that people were like celebrating and chanting his name on Sunday?
I mean, it was really moving in his concession speech or whatever you call it. I'm going to say this positively this time. You guys really carried me through, and he seemed to mean it. There's a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde thing with him, you know, where I think sometimes on court, he seems overcome by this like rage and he can't seem to see past it. This is something he's talked about pretty openly. People have compared him to, you know, a guy like Nick Kyrgios, but he seems very different because he does seem actively to be working on this. He has a psychologist sitting in his player's box. You know, this is something he's kind of owned a little bit in the past. It's really important to acknowledge that he's acted like a bad guy in the past. He's said some really awful things. It's also great that he's owning up to it and kind of working on it. So I give him a lot of credit. I think he's a little bit crazy. And maybe it was going to take a guy with a little bit of crazy to be the first one to break through, because there is no traditional deference to him. There is just a little crack that I can't peer into, and it's awesome.
I would push back on that a little bit because I think Kyrgios has also been open and talked about how he needs to work on things and fix it. And I think part of it is just like we need to wait and see if his behavior changes and how it changes. He's definitely now gotten affirmation and the benefit of the doubt from the crowd based on his play. And he's can be a very charming guy. I think the big difference between him and Kyrgios, Stefan, is that Medvedev has shown in a shorter time in the spotlight of the sport, but that he can use and channel his anger in a positive way as far as results go on the court. Like, I haven't seen an example, at least this year, of him getting mad and him then playing worse. It seems like it's actually the opposite.
Right, and I saw no evidence. You saw no evidence in the Nadal match, particularly, of him getting frustrated or down or banging anything or throwing anything in the first two sets plus. And as far as the crowd goes, he definitely challenged it, but it also felt like this was like the classic example of a New York U.S. Open crowd trying to behave like it thinks a New York U.S. Open crowd is supposed to behave. And I didn't feel like they went far enough in the final. It was still predominantly Nadal focused and Rafa chants. If the New York crowd really wanted to live up to the stereotype, it totally should have gone all in on Medvedev during the comeback.
Louisa Thomas, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I feel like this next segment, like some famous person receiving some dumb award, needs no introduction. But it is worth noting that the last 2 months of Antonio Brown's life certainly are the first in the history of humankind to involve a hot air balloon, cryotherapy-induced frostbite, football helmet certification standards, the word cracker, a possibly illegal wiretap, a professionally crafted Instagram video, John Gruden, and Bill Belichick. One of the best wide receivers of the last decade is a New England Patriot now, and I have to say that against all logic, I love this outcome with the fire of 10,000 suns. Joining us now is Slate's Ben Mathis-Lilly. Hey, Ben.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good. Not as good as Antonio Brown, though. The Brown saga is at once totally absurd and amusing, but it's also really serious in what it says about the rules that govern where professional athletes get to play and how they can maneuver to do that. I don't think there are any angels in this story, Josh. There were problems with Antonio Brown's entire career and the way he's behaved, certainly at the end in Pittsburgh. But at the same time, I'm actually kind of sympathetic to him wanting to get out of a toxic situation and get out of, you know, playing in a place that maybe he didn't want to from the beginning.
A toxic situation.
That he helped create.
He was pouring the poison into a barrel with a skull and crossbones on it already. The thing that's the most fascinating about this is like working backwards through your whole list. If you want to read that list to us backwards now, Stefan, it ends with Belichick and then you have the surreptitious taping and then you go back through the helmet and the hot air balloon and the cryogenic foot burning. Like, I don't think he would have intentionally blistered his feet in a cryogenic chamber. But I think everything else has now been called into question. Was he sincere in not wanting to play because the NFL didn't allow him to wear his helmet? Or was that a way to get the Raiders to be annoyed with him and release him? It seems like towards the end, we now have enough reporting on, you know, Chris Mortensen reporting that he brought in social media consultants to like, how do I do bad tweets so the Raiders will release me? Like, he legitimately brought in consultants to figure out how can I frame what's happening with me and the Raiders so that they will release me. Like, at least part of this is clear, like intentional, bad and disruptive behavior so he can orchestrate his departure.
Absolutely.
And go to New England.
Right. And also, his agent is Drew Rosenhaus, and it would not surprise anybody if Rosenhaus was involved in helping to orchestrate some of this. I mean, that Instagram video, that was really professionally produced. I mean, somebody sat around and said, let's tape your conversation with your head coach, and then let's use that tape in a lovingly crafted Instagram video that will annoy the shit out of the organization and certainly lead to your release.
Do you have outside help with your bad tweets, Ben, or are they all yours?
Well, I like that the idea is that he had to ask someone if posting private correspondence from his boss, where they find him for conduct detrimental to the team, would be good or bad for his relationship.
It's
with
always
that
just
boss.
Good to make a phone call and consult an expert just to make sure that you have things right.
I certainly want to know how much that consultant bills per hour and you know, and then obviously how I can maybe become a part of that firm.
Let's listen to an excerpt from that video.
Let me ask you this. Do you want to be a writer or not?
I've been trying to be a writer since day one.
God, man, if I could work my ass so hard at anyone. I don't know why it's a question of me being a writer. Like, do you guys want me to be a writer?
Please stop this shit. Just play football. How hard is it, man? You're a great football player. Just play football.
Yeah, but I'm more than a football player, man. I'm a real person. It ain't about the football. I know how to do that. I'll show you guys down the daily. This is my life. Ain't no more games.
Ben, I think the most fascinating thing about that surreptitiously taped call with John Gruden is that, like, private phone call Gruden is the exact same as public Gruden. So while, like, Antonio Brown is out there just, like, saying different stuff to different people every second of every day, like, Gruden, who seems like the most, like, fake and cartoonish coach, is actually just being John Gruden all the time.
You're saying he's a fake and cartoonish person.
I wouldn't say that. I'm saying his cartoonishness is real. He's keeping it real.
Yeah. I think that the strange thing, given, as you guys have mentioned, that this was clearly a professionally produced and kind of premeditated video, is that I kind of came out of it thinking, like, yeah, John Gruden is the one who's handling the situation correctly. You know, like, he's like, hey, you're a great player. I love to have you on the team, but, like, you've got to, like, actually play for the team. I mean, is there anything really inappropriate about what Gruden is saying in that conversation?
No, and that's probably what Gruden said. I thought it was amusing. He didn't say, I'm hiring a lawyer to, like, investigate, you know, felony illegal wiretapping charges.
But that's why it's odd. It's like, obviously, the team is not going to look, despite what Gruden said, it's, like, not ideal to have a player release a video like this with private communication. But I don't know if Brown was trying to make Gruden look bad or what his goal was here. Because if he was trying, like, he's the one who ends up looking more like a heel. And, you know, posting the letter in which the team fined him on Instagram as well, confronting Mayock, maybe or maybe not calling him a cracker.
Mike, like, Mayock, the general manager.
Whatever Antonio Brown's intentions were, he got to where he wanted to go in the end. But people, whether it's in the NFL, fans, commentators, nobody is, like, thinking super highly of Antonio Brown today. And so from, like, a PR brand maintenance perspective, I guess he just, like, values being on the Patriots and potentially winning a Super Bowl more than, like, having people like him.
It's not as if people really liked Antonio Brown before he became an Oakland Raider
Not that much to lose, I guess.
No, but let's also evaluate the way the Raiders handled this. I mean, yeah, it is incredibly difficult for NFL teams to deal with this sort of behavior. You know, the distraction theory of how training camps and NFL hierarchies are supposed to run. But at the same time, you know, it was their choice to make a public show of fining him, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was their choice to go in front of microphones during training camp and ream him out. They knew what kind of a personality they were dealing with when they traded for him. So either you make real changes in your behavior, you make exceptions for someone like Antonio Brown, or you don't trade for the guy in the first place.
It's a mystery on almost every level. And I think that maybe the best explanation is just that neither party knew what they wanted. I think where the theory that he was orchestrating the move to the Patriots kind of falls apart is, as Mike Florio pointed out on Pro Football Talk, he lost, what, $21 million in guaranteed money here. And generally, being on the Patriots, you know, being on a good team for almost every athlete is not worth that much money. So I'm not entirely convinced that this was a, as they say in politics, a 12-dimensional chess move. It kind of seems like he wants to just do whatever he wants, and he wants people to respect him for that. And beyond those two goals, I'm not sure if he had any kind of premeditated kind of strategy to this.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of the mind of fuck Mike Mayock and fuck John Gruden and fuck the NFL. Antonio Brown found a way to subvert the most draconian, absurd salary system in professional sports. He's clearly a different person, to put it mildly, but he also recognized his value, his agency. His agent advised him correctly how to fuck over his ridiculous employers, and he becomes an unrestricted free agent after this season. So he makes maybe up to $15 million this year, so half of what he was guaranteed in Oakland, and he gets to hit the free agent market after playing in New England, and presumably, obviously, no guarantees here, but if past is any predictor, that he will behave and catch and do well.
We should also say that when the Raiders, as you said, made a public show of finding him all this money, they also voided the guarantees in his contract. And so at that point,
what was he going
to
do?
Well, at that point, it became obvious that Brown was trying to get released and even said publicly, release me.
Wait. At that point, it was obvious that the Raiders wanted to get rid of him.
Yeah. So there was some kind of mutual interest there in this outcome, if not in the outcome of him going to the Patriots. I don't think anybody but the Patriots wanted him to go to the Patriots and Antonio Brown. But, you know, Ben, as we're making this calculation, Stefan says, like, he becomes an unrestricted free agent now after this season. And so it's not like, and he was actually, he could have signed with anybody before he made the deal with the Patriots. So he lost all these guarantees, but he could have gotten any kind of contract with any kind of team that he wanted to. He just chose to take this deal with the Patriots and then become a free agent again, presumably after having, you know, he's betting on himself that he's going to have a strong season.
Sure. And, you know, but it's football, you know, betting on himself, having a strong season and remaining healthy, which is obviously a lot more fraught. I mean, even in other sports, basketball, baseball, you know, generally players don't like to make the bet that they're going to remain healthy for an entire season. And then this is, you know, a much more dangerous sport than any of those. So if he is doing this, I mean, it's got to be one of the most extreme, if not the most extreme move we've seen in the player empowerment area, you know, to give up $20 million in, you know, betting on yourself that you're going to stay
healthy.
I mean,
given what we've seen in the last few months, I can't imagine Antonio Brown doing something extreme. Like, what are the chances that he would do something bizarre and unprecedented?
Well, but that's kind of what goes back to the Raiders' mistake in all of this. I mean, like, the idea that you're going to get Antonio Brown to play for your team and then just not, and that you're going to bring him to heel. I mean, that's obviously, to me, their central mistake, right? Like, you get this guy on your team and you've got to let him do whatever he wants. I mean, that's just, you know, that's not maybe fair, but this is someone who, I was just looking at this, he either went to or considered and had a problem with going to Florida State, Alcorn State, North Carolina Tech Prep, Florida International, and Central Michigan. That's just his college career. So the idea that you could get this person at his current age and kind of by like using fines, get him into, make him into a kind of Gruden grinder. I mean, that's to me the most ridiculous mistake in all of this.
Right. And that's the conceit of people like John Gruden and the NFL more largely. I mean, if you watched any of Hard Knocks, Gruden standing in front of the room, you know, calling these guys men and screaming at them to buy into the Raider way and, you know, treating them like they are, you know, college or high school players. And, you know, Gruden believes, like you said, Josh, he is a caricature of himself. And to believe that that sort of behavior was going to work with a guy like Antonio Brown is foolish and was foolish from the beginning. And in terms of early resentment for Brown's going to the Raiders, Charles Robinson of Yahoo reported over the weekend that the Patriots were interested in trading for him back in the spring in the offseason.
They're even willing to trade a first-round pick.
And the Steelers didn't want to do it. That probably didn't endear Antonio Brown to whatever team he was going to end up with either.
So I can imagine a scenario in which you guys would say that it's wrong for a team to accommodate an asshole, prima donna, jerk player and to set different rules for him. I think I don't want to come off sounding like a management stooge, and the Raiders are clearly like
Stooges?
Not the best run franchise, and Gruden and Mayock both seem like a little bit high on their own supply. That being said, I can imagine being a guy on that team and not wanting Antonio Brown around based on they already were setting different rules for him, like based on, you know, in the first episode of Hard Knocks, they made this whole big like thing out of this, you know, undrafted rookie from Last Chance U. You know, he got hurt and they like cut him to make a point about how, oh, you've got to like really want to be here. And Antonio Brown is off like fucking doing whatever the hell it is he's doing, like not practicing with the team, doing, you know, his own drills with his own trainer. And they're talking about what a great guy and what a great talent he is. I mean, they were, how differently can you treat someone? And there has to be a point at which, look, again, I have no sympathy for the Raiders. I think that the NFL CBA is bad. But like, what are they expected or supposed to do with players, a guy who like won't play?
Teammates hate this shit. They were no doubt in the locker room when the Hard Knocks cameras were turned off, rolling their eyes and getting pissed off that this asshole was making a mockery of their own work, because they are there doing the work that is required of them and he wasn't. Teams, players despise this kind of behavior. They don't like having these prima donnas dictate. Having said that, the Raiders chose to trade for him, and that is the part of this that leaves me with zero sympathy for these assholes. So either that like you want to bring someone like Antonio Brown in with all of the baggage, you're not going to bring him to heel. Maybe Bill Belichick really is the only coach in the NFL.
No, the Steelers and Mike Tomlin. The Steelers and Mike Tomlin kept him around for like 8 years, and he, you know, it wasn't until the very end that relationship broke apart. And so we don't necessarily know.
Reportedly, by the way, because he threw a football at Ben Roethlisberger.
And yeah, nobody likes Ben Roethlisberger. So I think, no, but seriously, I think when that went down, we said, and everybody said really, that the Steelers were being dumb. They were losing all this cap room. The Raiders were getting this like great talent for just a few picks. But maybe behind the scenes, the Steelers and Mike Tomlin or whoever else were doing an amazing job keeping everyone together. Maybe
right.
Antonio Brown didn't start acting in the more kind of outward public teammate and management pissing off way until later in his tenure. But this is really the Steelers' fault for making him seem normal for most of his career. But let's talk about the collective bargaining agreement. Howard Bryant tweeted, it appears players are finding new and disruptive ways to engineer their unrestricted free agency. I hope this kind of effort goes into the next CBA. And so the argument there, and this is kind of tied into the Anthony Davis thing and players demanding trades when they have increasing amount of time left on their deals in the NBA, but this notion that in the absence of more player-friendly rules and collective bargaining agreements for leagues, that players will find a way, that in this era, the empowerment era, players will figure out how to get where they want to get. Do you think that is what's going on here, Stefan?
I think partly that's what's going on here. I mean, it's hard to be an NFL superstar even and look at the absence of guarantees, though those are happening with greater frequency.
Yeah, Julio Jones.
Julio Jones' contract over the weekend.
Yeah, just got like a deal that's like 97% guaranteed. That's unprecedented in the league. Top receiver deal in the league. Antonio Brown did not have a deal with that many guarantees in it, even before the guarantees got voided.
Right. So players and their agents notice all of this. They're not dumb to the lack of guarantees and the lack of influence that they have over their careers. And they're going to do whatever they can to engineer that in their own ways, especially when they look at the NBA and they look at other sports that do have those sorts of promises built in to their contracts. So the question is, what happens in the next CBA? How does the NFL give something, and what do they get in exchange for giving players more guaranteed money and maybe more power over getting out of contracts at different stages of their career? You know, the talk is like moving to an 18-game season, and what trade-offs do you need to do to achieve that? They've got to be probably pretty high trade-offs. One of the things that's been talked about is that the 18-game season, the NFL would have to give the players a lot to get two more games back. So another thing that people talk about is an expanded playoffs. But regardless, more games, more hits, more deterioration, more injuries, a lot of revenue is going to have to come toward the players, or a lot more in terms of player freedom and guaranteed money.
I guess the final kind of story here, Ben, is the Patriots. They blew out the Steelers on Sunday Night Football this week. Brown did not play against his former team. He's going to be eligible to play in week two. But this is kind of a classic Patriots move. It's like how they dealt for Randy Moss from the Raiders more than a decade ago. They now went from having a thin receiving core to having Julian Edelman, Antonio Brown,
Josh Gordon.
Yeah.
This is, I think, both for fans and for other teams, just like yet another data point of this franchise kind of having dominion over the league in what seems like an unfair way, an annoying way. I don't know how you would frame it.
I think that what really remains to be seen is whether Antonio Brown actually likes playing for the Patriots. I think we're kind of assuming that. But I think given what we were just talking about, this is someone who doesn't seem to really like rules or being told what to do. And that is kind of incompatible with playing professional football. So I wouldn't be surprised if we were, or you guys were having this discussion again in a week where it went after Antonio Brown retires, you know, I think it's, you know, the Patriots have built up this reputation through Moss and through other players. But I think that this, as it is for the CBA, as it was for the Raiders, will be perhaps the most extreme, kind of test case for player empowerment that they have seen as well.
Yeah, and I guess we'll see very soon how much of this was performance art and how much of it was real acting out.
Yeah, and it's fun for the media to sort of talk about Bill Belichick and make fun of him, you know, the grumpy old guy in front of the microphone at press conferences. But the thing you always hear is that players actually like playing for Bill Belichick.
They respect the fact that he's such an asshole and will cut them at the drop of a hat. Everybody loves that.
It's the great irony.
Isn't it just that he likes you fine if you quote unquote do your job? I mean, that's kind of that seems to be what Antonio Brown in his way has been asking for this whole time. It's like, just let me show up when I want to play the game. And if I play the game well, then let me do whatever I want. And that's kind of, I guess, how it might go in New England.
Yeah, except that the Patriots over the years have found ways to deal with players that come in with some baggage. Randy Moss, I mean, they've made exceptions for the way that Tom Brady behaves. They've made exceptions for the way that Rob Gronkowski behaved with the team. So it's not unprecedented that Bill Belichick can find a way to accommodate Antonio Brown's personality.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
All right, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Stefan and I and Ben will discuss the opening weekend of the college football season with an emphasis on Michigan's near defeat to Army, the phenomenon of the near upset in college football. Let's discuss. If you want to hear that, you're not a member, you can sign up for Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can do that signing up at slate.com/hangoutplus. On Saturday afternoon in Clemson, South Carolina, the Clemson Tigers played what was supposed to be, according to the Vegas oddsmakers, their toughest game of the regular season. The Texas A&M Aggies, who played Clemson close at home last year, did not present any kind of challenge, though. Clemson dominated 24-10 win. It was 24-3 until the final seconds. Clemson destroyed Alabama to win last year's national title. They now have a clear path to make the college football playoff for the fifth straight season under their head coach, Dabo Swinney. Ben, you are still with us. You wrote a great piece for Slate last week about how Clemson became a football power, because before Swinney took over 11 years ago, it really was not a football power. In that piece, you focused on a guy named Thad Turnipseed. Who is Thad Turnipseed? Why did you want to write about him?
I'm kind of interested in how college programs succeed or fail, right? Like, and as you said, Clemson was a fine program under Tommy Bowden. You know, they won more than they lost, but I don't think anyone thought of them as an elite or a blue blood school. It was kind of they won a national championship in the 80s, but that seemed kind of like an outlier. And it was after last year's national championship where, as you mentioned, they were so dominant over Alabama, which of course is the dominant team of this generation in college football. And they just embarrassed them in the final. And I kind of started wondering, well, how do you do this? How do you just make this out of from scratch? And so I looked a little bit into the program to be honest, I found Thad Turnipseed because I was looking at the names of people on Clemson's coaching staff and support staff, and I thought he had the most interesting name. Turns out he also has one of the most interesting jobs because he runs their recruiting program, and he built their football facility, which is like in, you know, the perpetual arms race of college football facilities. It is the, you know, nuclear bomb to destroy all nuclear bombs. It has a wiffle ball field. It has a bowling alley. It has a nap room. It has an arcade.
When you said wiffle ball field, Stefan committed to Clemson.
I committed to Clemson immediately, yeah. I think I have eligibility.
And as I kind of point I made in the piece, and with Thad Turnipseed and with Dabo Swinney, they have covered kind of every base, pun not intended, of what a certain kind of 17-year-old, 18-year-old prospect would want.
This is a tactic that every big school, we just talked about LSU building that a huge facility designed to basically cradle to grave the football players so they never have to leave.
That's really dark.
Fourth 4 years.
Cradle to grave.
The idea is that they are completely under the sway of the program. Every big school has figured that part out. That's why there are tutors inside the athletic department building, and that's why there are all these amenities, and that's why there are nap rooms, and that's why there are their own cafeterias. Clemson, though, it seems, is just taking it to the highest possible level in terms of spending $55 million to renovate the football complex. And the sort of, as you say, explicit literal goal of keeping the players there as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, so and it pays off. As I mentioned in the piece, if you look at their APR, which is academic progress rate, it's a measure the NCAA uses. They keep players in their program. They keep players in school. They keep players, making their grades. And when you look at the people on the field, it's upperclassmen. So they really do, with this facility and other things about their program, a very impressive job of getting players developed and, you know, this idea of keeping them around the facility so they have more time with the coaches. And
very
coaches
impressive. Also Orwellian. Yeah. I mean, they check into the dining hall, scan their thumbs, and they're told what to eat.
Yes, I think that there are two ways of looking at it, right? Yeah, I mean, as a college football fan, I'm impressed. As a person, I'm a little taken aback by the extent to which they go with some of this stuff.
Well, it's kind of the opposite of what we were just talking about with Antonio Brown. It's the ability to have players conform and all be doing the same thing in the same place at the same time all the time and actually be happy about it and want to be there. And I think Clemson, more than any other school, you know, top level, high level football program, has figured out how to do that. And I think a big thing that distinguished them from Alabama, which has been their big national rival over the last 5 years, is not just the ability to keep the players there, but the ability to keep the staff together. Alabama is constantly having to churn top assistants. And I think that, you know, there's an argument that finally caught up to them in the national championship game last year. Whereas Clemson has these dudes. I mean, you wrote about, Turnip Seed having an amazing resume to be an athletic director and just deciding, I don't want to leave. I want to be here with Dabo because this is where I'm meant to be. Brent Venables, the defensive coordinator, a million schools would want to hire him, and he just hasn't wanted to leave either. And so that's been where, I found it really interesting in your piece, your description of how Dabo and Clemson kind of convinces these guys that there's no higher ideal than working for Dabo at Clemson.
Right, because you could argue that the players really don't have a choice.
Yeah.
If they want to leave, they got to sit out a year in most cases. They're not getting paid. The coaching staff, there are millions of dollars more in some cases awaiting them if they were to go elsewhere.
Right, and I think that goes back to kind of the uniqueness of Clemson's situation. It's in a small town, town about 17,000 people. It's at the base of the mountains. It's not a metropolis. So I think what Dabo does very well is he finds people who are going to want him to stay in that situation. So he finds people like Tad Turnipseed, who's from Alabama. He finds people like the coordinators who, I think he pre-selects the people around him to be content, in a small town in the South, just caring about football, and obviously you can get some pretty, pretty talented people that way. And then there's the other part of it where, he kind of repeatedly and surreptitiously uses the phrase bloom where you're planted. Yeah. At every possible opportunity, kind of like builds a whole ethos around the program that, being ambitious is not that great, so. Again, there's two sides of it. There's the part where, for some of these guys, I certainly understand why, for the coordinators, like, why move yourself to Kansas, a job that's always coming open, to lose 11 games a year? When you have your family, you have your life, you get paid a ton of money. That's the other part of it. They pay their coordinators $2 million a year. So, I could see their perspective on it.
So a couple of folks that we work with who don't really follow college football read this piece, Ben, and said that it was incredibly creepy and that they didn't like. I think for us, we're like, yeah, this is just kind of how stuff goes. This seems like kind of an extreme example, like the anecdote of the guy at the Clemson all-in meeting who silenced his phone, even though his wife was 9 months pregnant and missed 7 calls from her. Like, right. That seems like on the outer limits of college football.
Wait, the 7 calls were her calling to say, I'm going to the hospital now.
That's correct.
Whatever, details. But like people who read this stuff, and I think this is a broader comment actually about how unbelievably strange and often inhumane college football and college sports culture is, and that like we as college sports fans, Ben, have just kind of internalized it and see it as normal. And it sometimes takes an outsider to be like, this is incredibly bizarre.
I don't know. I thought Ben did a really good job of persuading even someone that follows sports the way that we do that this is really creepy. I mean, the paragraph where you quote a bunch of different people repeating Dabo Swinney's catchphrase, bloom where you planted, I was completely creeped out after I read that. And my notes say it's a religious cult is what Clemson is. And football is at the center of it.
Sure. Yeah. Football and church. I mean, that's the other part, the big part of it, is Dabo's an outspoken evangelical guy. He recruits people. He tells them that they're going to have a Christian focus in the program. The coaches are Christian. Tad Turnip,
a public school, by the
Christian.
Way.
Right, it's a public school, and as I said in the piece, they've said that they comply with every law regarding the separation of church and state. But at the same time, we know that they have baptisms after practice sometimes at the pond next to the practice field. So right, that's another key part of it, is that you've got to get people who are willing to be not even put up with that, but to take part in it. And you got to find players, and you got to find coaches who are willing to do that, and at a public school. And then then maybe they cross a line there.
Sports Illustrated had a piece this week also about just that and the extent to which Clemson is this sort of religious football factory. It would take someone to there have been investigations by outside groups that have raised questions about whether this is legal or not, the way that Swinney runs this program.
The Chronicle of Higher Education did a really long and comprehensive piece about this way back in 2013. Like, the Sports Illustrated piece was valuable, but most of what was laid out there was already known because of that great Chronicle reporting from 6 years ago.
Yeah. But it would take someone challenging this legally. You'd need plaintiffs, basically, to bring a case against Clemson. You know, to us, looking at it, I mean, to me, it is creepy. I mean, you know, Turnipseed, you say in the piece, has said that recruits are screened for prayerfulness, among other things, during their on-campus visits. Do they open the door for a lady? How do they talk to their mom? Do they pray before they eat? This is fucked up. And whether, as is repeated over and over again, that Swinney doesn't proselytize or pressure or discriminate, he says, I've had atheists on this team, I'm sure. It's, again, it's a public institution, and the issue of whether this appears to be okay is what is central, not whether he actually does something to restrict non-Christians from being on the team.
Well, and I think that the point about the success of the program is crucial, and the need for a plaintiff. I mean, right, like in that Sports Illustrated piece, you have guys talking about actions that certainly seem, you know, there's a guy saying I was in his office and I was a former player saying I was struggling on off the field, you know, and he said, well, hey, why don't you become born again? And you know, to me, seeing a public employee say that is probably improper. But the player says, well, it was great and I did it. It was great for my life. You know, and so as Josh has pointed out, you know, you got six guys drafted last year. They won four conference championships. They won two national titles that senior class. So it's going to take someone who's unhappy with that before anything is going to change. And right now, when you're winning your toughest game of the year by 14 points, there's not going to be a lot of unhappy people in that locker room.
And the players are self-selecting, I think, to a large degree. I mean, in the recruiting process, you often hear about the importance of recruiting the parents. And if you're recruiting, especially in the South, and you go into a house and talk about, you know, God and church and prayerfulness, that's not really going to limit your recruiting pool.
Right.
It's going to help. And telling, you know, parents that you're going to take care of their child spiritually, you know, in the Sports Illustrated piece, one of the parts of it that was new information and was valuable was talking about how that helped Clemson get the number one quarterback recruit in the 2020 class, a guy, DJ Ugalele. And Trevor Lawrence, the star quarterback who's a sophomore now, is Christian and talks about it a lot. And so I think Clemson is definitely helping itself rather than hurting itself by taking this approach as part of this larger approach around program cohesion and creating an environment that's enticing to, you know, teenagers.
But it's a very cloistered environment. It's a restricted environment. And Swinney is certainly not a progressive when it comes to anything having to do with player rights in college football. He openly has talked about his opposition to the idea of players ever being compensated. I mean, this is not a guy that is there to, you know, he's a guy that's there to find the best football players and win championships, like most of these guys. But there is zero evidence that he has a sort of larger vision for what college football could be for these kids that he's recruiting.
He also talked about how players protesting were like disgracing the legacy of Martin Luther King. And this is a guy who has the highest paying contract in all of college sports for a coach. I guess the question, Ben, is, you know, we're picking on Clemson a lot here. The religious aspect is Clemson specific, but a lot of what we're talking about is more common in college football. So is it right for us just to focus on Clemson because they're on top, or should this actually just be a bigger conversation about what the norms are in college football?
I think the latter. I mean, I agree with everyone who said, well, this, you know, some of these behaviors are kind of creepy, but it's like you're saying, I think basically what they've done is they've taken everything that happens in every college football program or most college football programs, and they just do it, I don't know, 10% more, 15% more. they just take it to a little. I mean, certainly they're not the only college program where the coach is espousing Christianity. I mean, they're not the only college program where people watching recruits on an official visit probably, you know, go back to their spreadsheet and document the recruit's behavior. I bet that happens other places too. And so, yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that and what Dabo has done is he's taken this existing system, this status quo, and he's just taken it to an extreme that kind of exposes some of its absurdities in a way that maybe other programs don't. But yes, absolutely. I don't think that there's programs where, you know, I don't think that there's, by contrast, any program where the players are encouraged to, you know, spend time on their own and think freely and, you know, come into the football facility a couple hours a week if you want to. I don't think that happens anywhere.
Another thing we should note is that if true, you know, there's this allegation on an FBI wiretap, a Clemson assistant basketball coach said that the reason that the football program is so successful is that they pay players under the table. Clemson, the athletic department has said, what did they say exactly, Ben, that they looked into it and there's no credence, they give no credence to it?
Yeah, they've said that they would investigate it, and that and the latest word from them was that they've not found anything improper. But again, it's if they were doing it, would they be the only team in the ACC doing it, the only team in the South doing it?
Certainly not.
That's very unlikely, yeah.
It would be nice for the players if they're getting a little money. Would make Dabo into a bit of a hypocrite, but that's okay.
As long as they tithe some of the money that they're given by the boosters, that's okay.
Ben, we'll post a link to your story on Thad Turnipseed and Clemson football on our show page. Thank you for coming on the show this week.
Thanks, guys.
Now it is time for After Balls. Let's go back to Serena Williams. There's been a lot of talk about how she won the U.S. Open 20 years ago. She was 17. But Serena Williams' first Grand Slam final came in 1998 when she was 16. It was in mixed doubles at the French Open, and her partner was, I'm sure you're going to guess this.
No, I'm not going to guess it.
Luis Lobo of Argentina.
Of course.
The immortal Luis Lobo. Serena and Lobo lost in the final to her sister Venus and Justin Gimelstob. The less said about Justin Gimelstob, the better. Just Google him. But anyway, a short while later at Wimbledon, Serena won her first Grand Slam title, also in mixed doubles, this time with Max Murnie. That September, Serena suggested that Lobo and Murnie could have a wrestling battle to see who could continue on as her mixed doubles partner, with Murnie saying, sure. There is no indication that said wrestling battle ever happened, though. Serena and Murnie did win the U.S. Open that year. Well, Luis Lobo became a coach. He works with Carlos Moya, David Nalbandian, Juan Monaco. And in 2019, he became an afterball name. Stefan, what is your Luis Lobo?
The high school football season has begun, which means the reports of Friday night carnage have resumed. There have already been, by the Google counting and retweeting of Kent Johnson, who tracks this stuff, at least 3 catastrophic brain injuries, a half dozen airlifts, and dozens of rides in ambulances in the name of King football. Last year, I became obsessed with real-time injury retweets from our Fields of Glory, compiled and distributed mainly by 3 football and brain injury gadflies, Johnson, Kimberly Archie, and a Twitter user named Concerned Mom. I read a bunch of them here, and I keep rereading them now. The happy play-by-play of a game in a place you've never heard of, interrupted by the report of an injury, a hushed crowd, the player down for X minutes, teammates and opponents on a knee, hands held, the player stretchered off, the good news of the player thumbs-upping the crowd, the game resuming, the final score reported matter-of-factly. But the tweets are sometimes accompanied by photos of the ambulance on the field removing the wounded. They are scenes so uniquely American they could have been painted by Hopper or Rockwell. Like the words, collectively they are repetitive and numbing and familiar and banal. Individually, though, they are grotesquely mesmerizing. They convey the stillness of tragedy and in so doing drain football of what makes it alluring, the speed and violence and testosterone, exposing it finally for what it is, an injury delivery system. They are a perfect representation of our most popular sport in these times, CTE porn with kids. Here's an archetypal one. Last Friday, Apollo Ridge versus Carlinton in Western Pennsylvania. Local reporter Kyle Dawson tweets the news. Carlinton's Chauncey Mickens is down after a first down carry, and they're bringing a stretcher and ambulance across the field to attend to him. And he attaches a photo. The red ambulance is on the far side of the field, parked between the 45 and 35 yard lines, framed perfectly by the yardage sticks behind it. In the foreground on the field, a group of Apollo Ridge players kneels in front of the coaches. The bench players kneel along the bottom edge of the frame. The Carlinton players kneel just beyond the ambulance, watching their teammate, his body hidden from view, get loaded onto a gurney. It's night, the field is bathed in light, the refs and the ambulance cast long shadows. Lurking in the dark in the distance is a yellow school bus, which I imagine took the visiting players home, except for one. This past Saturday night, Ventura County, California, two ambulances parked side by side on the 35. A giant illuminated image of a lion, the home team mascot, glows behind metal bleachers. Players from Oaks Christian and Sierra Canyon High Schools cluster in a V formation like geese as senior linebacker and running back Mr. Williams is loaded into the ambulance with a neck injury. Williams remained nearly motionless on the Oaks Christian Stadium turf for more than 20 minutes after being tackled on a running play with 1:32 left in the third quarter, the local paper reports. Big Bear, California, August 23rd. The ambulance is parked at an angle on the clumpy grass field. The oversized coaches hover over the fallen player. Three refs stand a few feet away, the game ball at their feet, ready for the inevitable restart. Two people watch from a small camera tower above the stands. Injury timeout for Big Bear injury on the fourth play of the game, tweets the photographer Kathy Porty, senior editor of the Big Bear Grizzly, the local paper. No details on injury. Bears down to 23 players suited up for the game. On and on they go. There are at least a few every weekend. Here's one more. The most morbidly beautiful photo I found from the Moab, Utah Times, August 15th. Grand County High School, full pads preseason practice. It's twilight. A single stand of lights fronts a cottony line of trees, which fronts the rust-colored mountains. This ambulance is parallel to the yard lines, pointed at empty stands topped by a press box the color of Roland Garros clay, labeled Red Devils in a funky font. The players on their knees face the rear of the ambulance. A single fireman walks in the foreground across the track toward the scene. The unnamed player suffered a bruised spinal cord, the paper reported. It was unclear whether he would be able to play in the team's first game later that day. We'll post links to some of these images so you can get a feel for what the ambulance on the field photo looks like and why they're so captivating. Josh, what's your Luis Lobo?
On Saturday night in Austin, the LSU Tigers came away with a glorious 45-38 win over the Texas Longhorns. It was a hot and humid day, temperatures nearing 100. Players kept leaving the field with cramps. On one long drive in the third quarter, four guys fell to the ground and had to leave. It turned out that every single player who cramped up during the game was on the LSU defense. There's been some speculation on message boards and in the Texas-based media after the game that these players were faking, that they fell to the ground to slow down the pace of play, catch their breath, and stop the Texas offense's momentum. And they did this so LSU didn't have to call a timeout or take a penalty. A couple of LSU players, Grant Delpit and Michael Divinity, it was reported, did go to the locker room to get IVs. So if they were faking, then that's pretty amazing commitment to the bit. But it is certainly possible that not all of these were legitimate cramps. And so now, Stefan, you talked about real football injuries. Mm-hmm. I will talk about fake football injuries. Fake cramps have been an epidemic in college football since the rise of high-speed, up-tempo offenses, particularly in the last decade. The New York Times ran a piece in 2010 about the injury-faking opponents of Chip Kelly's hyperspeed Oregon Ducks, noting that Cal actually suspended its defensive line coach for telling a player to flop intentionally. A year later, there's a mini controversy after the Giants faked injuries to slow down the St. Louis Rams on Monday Night Football. An item in Pro Football Talk noted an earlier incident in which, quote, Patriots linebacker Willie McGinnis went down with an alleged injury late in the fourth quarter of a 2003 game against the Colts, only to, quote, recover a minute later to get back on the field and make the game-saving tackle. Pro Football Talk also mentioned that opponents of the Boomer Esiason, Sam Weish, no-huddle Cincinnati Bengals of the 80s and 90s used to fake injuries, and that Weish, quote, thought the referee should award his team a touchdown as a penalty for a palpably unfair act. So college football and the NFL have rules to deal with injuries in the last minute in college, in the last 2 minutes of a half in the NFL. They charge the injured player's team a timeout. There's the potential to have a runoff of the game clock, so that clock stopping just can't be as easy as having a guy fall down. And so I was interested to learn when all this started. It wasn't actually with Oregon. It wasn't even with the Cincinnati Bengals. I thought that this was just a scourge of modern football, but it turns out that this used to happen all the time, and that those rules about the last minute of the half in college actually stem from a particular incident. November 21st, 1953. I also learned about this from that same Pro Football Talk item, by the way. On November 21st, 1953, number one Notre Dame played Iowa in South Bend. I'm going to read the AP's story on the game, which I found on newspapers.com in a newspaper in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the Gazette. So this is the Iowa spin on the game. The headline is Varacchione should get an Oscar. Frank Varacchione, Notre Dame's 205-pound junior tackle from Natick, Mass., qualified for an Oscar Saturday for his dramatic portrayal of an injured football player. As the clock ticked off the final seconds before halftime, Varacchione let out a squeal on the field, held his back, and began staggering. Officials called an injured player timeout, stopping the clock with 1 second remaining in the half. Varacchione was replaced with time for one play. Notre Dame scored on a 12-yard pass. The conversion was made, giving the Irish a 7-7 halftime tie. The game eventually ended in a 14-14 deadlock. Varacchione played all but a few minutes of the last half. Was he really hurt? In his dormitory room, 2 hours after the game, a reporter, and I'll pause to say here, this is intrepid reporting, a reporter found the husky tackle lying down and looking the picture of health. He would not admit anything. He said he had no comment whatsoever. No use asking questions because I'm not going to talk about it, he insisted. A reporter asked, don't you think feigning injury to stop the clock was using your head? You didn't know how many official timeouts the team had, and you didn't want to take a chance of the team later getting penalized for too many timeouts. I'm not saying anything, Varacchione replied. We saw you get up after the play just previously, the reporter said. Then you looked at the clock and started screaming and holding your back or leg. Were you really hurt? What do you think? He parried. Johnny Ladner, Notre Dame's All-America halfback, was asked about Varacchione. He said, pretty smart thinking, wasn't it? That tricky, tricky Fighting Irish. Frank Varacchione died last year at the age of 85. He became known as Faintin' Frank. The Cedar Rapids Gazette actually printed a poem about this incident that began, oh, Paddy dear, and did you hear the news that's going around? How Notre Dame is winning games with players on the ground. The first to hit the ground this day was Frank Varacchione. The Irish claim that he was hurt, but others cry. Baloney. Neil Rosendahl had a good blog post on this that noted the consequences of this action. Notre Dame fell in the AP polls, which back then there's no BCS. There's no the AP poll was actually what determined the national championship. So they fell to number two. They ended up behind Maryland. So this is the reason for Maryland winning the national, its only national championship. Notre Dame could not climb back to number one in the polls. Another consequence is that rules were put in about stopping the clock at the end of each half, as I noted earlier. And then this is like actually controversial, and I'm not sure who's right here. But Frank Leahy, the legendary Notre Dame coach of the day, did not coach after that season. It was reported at the time and has long been believed that it was because of health reasons. But this blog post I read by Neil Rosendahl, and I've saw some other people make this argument as well, that Leahy actually reputationally was damaged by this moment and by Notre Dame getting the reputation for feigning injuries. This blog post says, the public stance behind Leahy's retirement has always been there was for health reasons. But Notre Dame's administration, particularly Father Hesburg, was incensed by Leahy's fainting Irish tactics and essentially let Leahy go. So if anybody is a Notre Dame football historian, wants to weigh in on what the real reason is, let us know. That is our show for today. Our producer is Melissa Kaplan. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup, and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. If you're still here, stick around. We've got more Hang Up to come if you are a Slate Plus member. In our bonus segment, This week, we talk with Ben Mathis-Lilly about the phenomenon of the near college football upset as exemplified by this weekend's Michigan-Army game.
You're looking at Michigan playing poorly against the Army and looking at when the guy was lining up the field goal, looking at kind of an epic loss. And then you can just feel the air getting taken out of all the games that come after it, which is why, in a weird way, watching that game was worse in some senses than watching the Ohio State last year, which was like another crushing defeat, you know, at the end of the season.
To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.